Bring up the bodies. Disc 6.
The king says, "When I remember what I did for the present queen, how I raised her from a gentleman's daughter, I cannot think now why I did it."
He looks at them as if to say, "Do you know Dr. Cramuel?"
"It seems to me..."
He is groping, perplexed for the right phrases.
"It seems to me I was somehow dishonestly led into this marriage."
He, Cromwell, eyes the other half of himself as if through a mirror. Cranmer looks thrown.
"How dishonestly?"
the Archbishop asks.
"I feel sure I was not in my clear mind then. Not as I am now."
"But, sir,"
Cranmer says,
"Majesty, saving your grace, your mind cannot be clear. You have suffered a great loss."
"Two, in fact," he thinks. "Today your son was born dead and your first wife buried. No wonder you tremble."
"It seems to me I was seduced,"
Henry says.
"That is to say, I was practiced upon, perhaps by charms, perhaps by spells. Women do use such things. And if that was so, then the marriage would be null, would it not?"
Cranmer holds out his hands, like a man trying to send back the tide. He sees his queen vanishing into thin air, his queen who has done so much for true religion.
"Sir, sir, Majesty—"
"Oh, peace,"
Henry says, as if it were Cranmer who had started it.
"Cromwell, when you were soldiering, did you ever hear of anything that would heal a leg like mine? I have knocked it again now, and the surgeons say the foul humours must come out. They fear that the rot has got as far as the bone. But do not tell anybody. I would not like word to spread abroad. Will you send a page to find Thomas Vickery? I think he must bleed me. I need some relief. Give you good night,"
he adds, almost under his breath,
"for I suppose even this day must end."
Dr. Cramuel goes out. In an antechamber, one of him turns to the other.
"You will be different tomorrow,"
the Archbishop says.
"Yes, a man in pain will say anything."
"We should not heed it."
"No."
They are like two men crossing thin ice, leaning into each other, taking tiny, timid steps, as if that will do you any good when it begins to crack on every side. Cranmer says uncertainly,
"Grief for the child sways him. Would he wait so long for Anne to throw her over so quickly? They will soon be perfect friends."
"Besides," he says, "he is not a man to admit he was wrong. He may have his doubts about his marriage, but God help anyone else who raises them."
"We must calm these doubts,"
Cranmer says.
"Between us, we must do it."
"He would like to be the Emperor's friend, now that Catherine is not there to cause ill feeling between them. And so we must face the fact that the present queen is..."
He hesitates to say, "superfluous." He hesitates to say, "an obstacle to peace."
"She is in his way,"
Cranmer says bluntly.
"But he will not sacrifice her. Surely he will not. Not to please Emperor Charles or any man. They need not think it. Rome need not think it. He will never revert."
"No. Have some faith in our good master to maintain the church."
Cranmer hears the words he has left unspoken. The king does not need Anne to help him do that. Although, he says to Cranmer, it is hard to remember the king before Anne, hard to imagine him without her. She hovers around him, she reads over his shoulder, she gets into his dreams. Even when she's lying next to him, it's not close enough for her.
"I tell you what we'll do," he says. He squeezes Cranmer's arm. "Let's give a dinner, shall we? And invite the Duke of Norfolk."
Cranmer shrinks.
"Norfolk? Why would we?"
"For reconciliation," he says breezily. "I fear that on the day of the king's accident I may have, slighted his pretensions. In a tent. When he raced in. Well-found pretensions," he adds reverently, "for is he not our senior peer? No, I pity the Duke from the bottom of my heart."
"What did you do, Cromwell?"
The Archbishop is pale.
"What did you do in that tent? Did you lay violent hands upon him, as I fear you did recently with the Duke of Suffolk?"
"What, Brandon? I was only moving him.
When he was not of a mind to be moved.
It was for his own good. If I had left him there in the king's presence, Charles would have talked himself into the tower. He was slandering the queen, you see.
And any slander, any doubt, he thinks, must come from Henry, out of his own mouth, and not from mine or any other man's.
Please, please, he says, let us have a dinner. You must give it at Lambeth. Norfolk will not come to me. He will think I plan to put a sleeping draught in the claret and convey him on board ship to be sold into slavery. He will like to come to you. I will supply the venison. We will have jellies in the shape of the Duke's major castles. It will be no cost to you, and no trouble to your cooks.
Cranmer laughs. At last he laughs. It has been a hard-fought campaign to get him even to smile.
As you wish, Thomas. We shall have a dinner.
The Archbishop sets his hands on his upper arms, kisses him right and left. The kiss of peace. He does not feel soothed or assuaged as he returns to his own rooms through the palace, unnaturally quiet. No music from distant rooms, perhaps the murmur of prayer. He tries to imagine the lost child, the mannequin, its limbs budding, its face old and wise. Few men have seen such a thing. Certainly he has not. In Italy once he stood holding up a light for a surgeon while in a sealed room draped in shadows he sliced a dead man apart to see what made him work. It was a fearful night, the stench of bowel and blood clogging the throat, and the artists who had jostled and bribed for a place tried to elbow him away, but he stood firm, for he had guaranteed to do so. He had said he would hold the light, and so he was among the elect of that company, the luminaries, who saw muscles stripped from bone. But he has never seen inside a woman, still less a gravid corpse. No surgeon, even for money, would perform that work for an audience. He thinks of Catherine, embalmed and entombed, her spirit cut free and gone to seek out her first husband, wandering now, calling his name. Will Arthur be shocked to see her? She is such a stout old woman, and he still a skinny child. King Arthur of blessed memory could not have a son. And what happened after Arthur, we don't know. But we know his glory vanished from the world. He thinks of Anne's chosen motto painted up with her coat of arms, the most happy. He had said to Jane Rochford, "How is my lady the queen?" Rochford had said, "Sitting up, lamenting?" He had meant, "Has she lost much blood?" Catherine was not without sin, but now her sins are taken off her. They are all heaped upon Anne, the shadow who flits after her, the woman draped in night. The old queen dwells in the radiance of God's presence, her dead infants swaddled at her feet. But Anne dwells in this sinful world below, stewed in her childbed sweat, in her soiled sheet. But her hands and feet are cold, and her heart is like a stone. So here's the Duke of Norfolk, expecting to be fed. Dressed in his best, or at least what's good enough for Lambeth Palace, he looks like a piece of rope chewed by a dog, or a piece of gristle left on the side of a trencher. Bright, fierce eyes under unruly brows, hair and iron stubble. His person is meagre, sinewy, and he smells of horses and leather and the armourer's shop, and mysteriously of furnaces, or perhaps of cooling ash, dust dry, pungent. He fears no one alive, except Henry Tudor, who could at a whim take his dukedom away, but he fears the dead. They say that at any of his houses at close of day you can hear him slamming the shutters and shooting the bolts, in case the late Cardinal Wolsey is blowing through a window or slithering up a stair. If Wolsey wanted Norfolk, he would lie quiet inside a tabletop, breathing along the grain of the wood. He would ooze through a keyhole, or flop down a chimney with a soft flurry like a soot-stained dove. When Anne Boleyn came up in the world, and she a niece of his illustrious family, the Duke thought his troubles were over. Because he has troubles. The greatest nobleman has his rivals, his ill wishers, his defamers. but he believed that, with Anne crowned in due time, he would be always at the king's right hand. It hasn't worked out like that, and the Duke has become disaffected. The match hasn't brought the Howards the riches and honours he expected. Anne has taken the rewards for herself, and Thomas Cromwell has taken them. The Duke thinks Anne should be guided by her male kin, but she won't be guided. In fact, she has made it plain that she sees herself and not the Duke as the head of the family now, which is unnatural in the Duke's view. A woman cannot be head of anything. Subordination and submission is her role. Let her be a queen and a rich woman, still she should know her place, or be taught it. Howard sometimes grumbles in public, not about Henry, but about Anne Boleyn. And he has found it expedient to spend his time in his own country, harassing his duchess, who often writes to Thomas Cromwell with complaints of his treatment of her. As if he, Thomas Cromwell, could turn the Duke into one of the world's great lovers, or even into a semblance of a reasonable man. But then, when Anne's latest pregnancy was known, the Duke had come to court, flanked by his smirking retainers and soon joined by his peculiar son. Surrey is a young man with a great conceit of himself as handsome, talented, and lucky. But his face is lopsided, and he does himself no favours in having his hair cut like a bull. Hans Holbein admits he finds him a challenge. Surrey is here tonight at Lambeth, forfeiting an evening in the brothel. His eyes roam about the room. Perhaps he thinks Cranmer keeps naked girls behind the arras.
"Well now," says the Duke, rubbing his hands, "when you coming down to see me at Kenning Hall, Thomas Cromwell? We have good hunting, by God. We have something to shoot at every season of the year. And we can get you a bed warmer if you want one. A common woman of the type you like. We have a maidservant just now." The Duke sucks in his breath. "You shall see her titties."
His knotty fingers knead the air.
"Well, if she's yours," he murmurs, "I wouldn't like to deprive you."
The Duke shoots a glance at Cranmer. Perhaps one ought not to talk about women. But then, Cranmer's not a proper archbishop, not in Norfolk's view. He's some petty clerk Henry found in the fens one year who promised to do anything he asked in return for a mitre and two good meals a day.
"By God, you look ill, Cranmer,"
the Duke says with gloomy relish.
"You look as if you can't keep the flesh on your bones."
"No more can I.
Look at this."
The Duke thrusts himself back from the table, elbowing a poor youth who stands ready with a wine jug. He stands up and parts his gown, thrusting out a skinny calf.
"What do you make of that?"
"That's horrible," he agrees. "It's humiliation, surely, that wears Thomas Howard to the bone." In company, his niece interrupts him and talks over him. She laughs at his holy medals and the relics he wears, some of them very sacred. At table she leans towards him, says, "Come, uncle, take a crumb from my hand. You are wasting away."
"And I am,"
he says.
"I don't know how you do it, Cromwell. Look at you, all fleshed out in your gown. An ogre would eat you roasted."
"Ah, well," he says, smiling, "that's the risk I run."
"I think you drink some powder that you got in Italy. Keeps you sleek. I suppose you wouldn't part with the secret."
"Eat up your jelly, my lord," he says patiently. "If I do hear of a powder, I will get a sample for you. My only secret is that I sleep at night. I am at peace with my Maker. And of course," he adds, leaning back at his ease, "I have no enemies."
"What?"
says the Duke. His eyebrows shoot up into his hair. He serves himself some more of Thurston's jelly crenellations, the scarlet and the pale, the airy stone and the bloody brick. As he swills them around his mouth, he opines on several topics, chiefly Wiltshire, the Queen's father, who should have brought Anne up properly and with more attention to discipline. But no, he was too busy boasting about her in French, boasting about what she would become.
"Well, she did become," says young Surrey. "Didn't she, my lord father?"
"I think it's she who's wasting me away," the Duke says. "She knows all about powders. They say she keeps poisoners in her house. You know what she did to old Bishop Fisher?"
"What did she do?"
young Surrey says.
"Do you know nothing, boy? Fisher's cook was paid to put a powder in the broth. It nigh killed him."
"That would have been no loss," the boy says. "He was a traitor."
"Yes," Norfolk says.
but in those days his treason stood still to be proved. This is not Italy, boy. We have courts of law. Well, the old fellow pulled around, but he was never well after. Henry had the cook boiled alive.
But he never confessed, he says, he, Cromwell. So we cannot say for sure the Boleyns did it. Norfolk snorts.
They had motive. Mary had better watch herself.
I agree, he says, though I do not think poison is the chief danger to her.
What then? Saudi says.
Bad advice, my lord.
You think she should listen to you, Cromwell?
Young Sari now lays down his knife and begins to complain.
Noblemen, he laments, are not respected as they were in the days when England was great.
The present king keeps about himself a collection of men of base degree, and no good will come of it. Cranmer creeps forward in his chair as if to intervene, but Sari gives him a glare that says, "You're exactly who I mean, Archbishop." He nods to a boy to refill the young man's glass. "You do not suit your talk to your audience, sir."
"Why should I?"
Surrey says. "Thomas Wyatt says you are studying to write verse. I am fond of poems, as I passed my youth among the Italians. If you would favour me, I would like to read some."
"No doubt you would," Surrey says, "but I keep them for my friends."
When he gets home, his son comes out to greet him.
"Have you heard what the Queen is doing? She has risen from her childbed, and things incredible are spoken of her. They say she was seen toasting cobnuts over the fire in her chamber, tossing them about in a Latin pan, ready to make poisoned sweetmeats for the Lady Mary."
"It would be someone else with a Latin pan," he says, smiling. "A minion. Weston. That boy Mark." Gregory sticks stubbornly by his version.
"It was herself, toasting. And the king came in and frowned to see her at the occupation, for he didn't know what it meant, and he has suspicions of her, you see. 'What are you at?' he asked. And Anne the Queen said, 'Oh, my lord, I am but making sweetmeats to reward the poor women who stand at the gate and call out their greetings to me.' The king said, 'Is it even so, sweetheart? Then bless you.' And so he was utterly misled, you see."
"And where did this happen, Gregory? You see, she is at Greenwich, and the king at Whitehall."
"No matter," Gregory says cheerfully. "In France, witches can fly, Latin pan and cobnuts and all, and that is where she learned it. In truth, the whole Boleyn affinity have become witches, to witch up a boy for her, for the king fears he can give her none."
His smile becomes pained. "Do not spread this about the household." Gregory says happily,
"Too late. The household has spread it about me."
He remembers Jane Rochford saying to him, it must be 2 years back, "The Queen has boasted she will give Catherine's daughter a breakfast she will not recover from." Merry at breakfast, dead by dinner. It was what they used to say about the sweating sickness that killed his wife and daughter. And unnatural ends, when they occur, are usually swifter than that. They cut down at a stroke. "I'm going to my rooms," he says. "I have to draw up a paper. Do not let me be interrupted. Richard may come in if he will."
"What about me? Can I come in? For instance, if the house were on fire, would you like to hear of it?"
"Not from you. Why would I believe you?" He pats his son, hurries off to his private room, and shuts the door. The meeting with Norfolk has, on the face of it, no payoff. But he takes his paper. At the top he writes, "Thomas Boleyn. This is the lady's father." He pictures him in his mind. An upright man, still lithe, proud of his looks, who pays great attention to turning himself out, just like his son George, a man to test the ingenuity of London goldsmiths, and to swivel around his fingers jewels which he says have been given him by foreign rulers. These many years he has served Henry as a diplomat, a trade for which he is fitted by his cold emollients. He is not a man wedded to action, Boleyn, but rather a man who stands by, smirking and stroking his beard. He thinks he looks enigmatic, but instead he looks as if he's pleasuring himself. Still, he knew how to act when the chance presented itself, how to set his family climbing, to the highest branches of the tree. It's cold up there when the wind blows, the cutting wind of 1536. As we know, his title of Earl of Wiltshire seems to him insufficient to indicate his special status, so he has invented for himself a French title, Monseigneur. And it gives him pleasure to be so addressed. He lets it be known this title should be universally adopted. From whether the courtiers comply, you can tell a great deal about where they stand. He writes, Monseigneur, all the Boleyns, their women, their chaplains, their servants. All the Boleyn toadies in the Privy Chamber, that is to say, Henry Norris, Francis Weston, William Brereton, etc. But plain old Wiltshire, delivered in accents brisk, the Duke of Norfolk, Sir Nicholas Carew of the Privy Chamber, his cousin to Edward Seymour and married to the sister of Sir Francis Bryan, cousin to the Boleyns, but cousin to the Seymours also, and friend of Mr. Treasurer William Fitzwilliam. He looks at this list. He adds the names of two grandees, the Marquis of Exeter, Henry Courtenay, Henry Pole, Lord Montague. These are the old families of England. They draw their claims from ancient lines. They smart more than any of us under the pretensions of the Boleyns. He rolls up his paper. Norfolk, Carew, Fitz, Francis Bryan, the Courtenays, the Montagues, and their ilk, and Suffolk, who hates Anne. It is a set of names. You cannot take too much from it. These people are not necessarily friends of each other. They are just, to one degree and another, friends of the old dispensation and enemies of the Boleyns. He closes his eyes. He sits, his breathing calm. In his mind, a picture appears, a lofty hall into which he commands a table. The trestles are lugged up by menials. The top is fixed in place. Liveried officials unroll the cloth, tweaking and smoothing. Like the king's tablecloth, it is blessed, its attendants murmuring a Latin formula as they stand back to take a view and even up the edges. So much for the table. Now for somewhere for the guests to sit. The servants scrape over the floor a weighty chair, the Howard coat of arms carved into its back. That's for the Duke of Norfolk, who lowers his bony bum. "What have you got?" he asks plaintively, "to tempt my appetite, Crumb?" "Now bring up another chair," he commands the servants. "Set it down at my Lord Norfolk's right hand. This one is for Henry Courtenay, the Marquis of Exeter, who says, "Cromwell, my wife insisted on coming." "It does my heart good to see you, Lady Gertrude," he says, bowing. "Take your seat." Until this dinner he's always tried to avoid this rash and interfering woman, but now he puts on his polite face. Any friend of the Lady Mary is welcome to dine. "The Princess Mary," Gertrude Courtenay snaps. "As you will, my lady," he sighs.
"Now here comes Henry Pole," Norfolk exclaims. "Will he steal my dinner?"
"There is food for all," he says. "Bring up another chair for Lord Montague. A fitting chair for a man of royal blood."
"We call it a throne," Montague says. "By the way, my mother is here."
Lady Margaret Pole, the Countess of Salisbury, rightful Queen of England, according to some. King Henry has taken a wise course with her and all her family. He has honoured them, cherished them, kept them close. Much good it's done him. They still think the Tudors are usurpers, though the Countess is fond of Princess Mary, whose childhood governor she was, honouring her more for her royal mother Catherine than for her father, whom she regards as the spawn of Welsh cattle raiders. Now the Countess, in his mind, creaks to her place. She stares around her.
"You have a magnificent hall here, Cromwell," she says, peeved.
"The rewards of vice," says her son Montague.
He bows again. He will swallow any insult at this point.
"Well," Norfolk says, "where's my first dish?"
"Patience, my lord," he says. He takes his own place, a humble three-legged stool, down at the end of the table. He gazes up at his betters. In a moment the platters will come in, but first, shall we say a grace? He glances up at the beams. Up there are carved and painted the faces of the dead, More, Fisher, the Cardinal, Catherine, the Queen. Below them, the flower of living England. Let us hope the roof doesn't fall in. The day after he, Thomas Cromwell, has exercised his imagination in this way, he feels the need to clarify his position in the real world and to add to the guest list. His daydream has not got as far as the actual feast, so he does not know what dishes he is going to offer. He must cook up something good, or the magnates will storm out, pulling off the cloth and kicking his servants. So, he now speaks to the Seymours, privately yet plainly. As long as the king holds by the queen that is now, I will hold by her too. But if he rejects her, I must reconsider. So you have no interest of your own in this? Edward Seymour says, skeptically. I represent the king's interests. That is what I am for. Edward knows he will get no further. Still, he says. Anne will soon be recovered from her mishap, and Henry can have her back in bed. But it is clear that the prospect has not made him lose interest in Jane. The game has changed, and Jane must be repositioned. The challenge puts a glint in Seymour's eyes. Now Anne has failed again. It is possible that Henry may wish to remarry. The whole court is talking of it. It is Anne Boleyn's former success that allows them to imagine it. You, Seymours, should not raise your hopes, he says. He falls out with Anne and falls in again. And then he cannot do too much for her. That is how they have always been. Tom Seymour says, Why would one prefer a tough old hen to a plump little chick? What use is it? Soup, he says, but not so that Tom can hear. The Seymours are in mourning, though not for the Dowager Catherine. Anthony Ortrud is dead, the governor of Jersey, and Jane's sister Elizabeth is left a widow. Tom Seymour says, If the king takes on Jane as his mistress, or whatever, we should look to make some great match for Bess. Edward says, Just stick to the matter in hand, brother. The brisk young widow comes to court to help the family in their campaign. He'd thought they'd call her Lizzie, this young woman, but it seems that was just her husband's name for her, and to her family she's Bess. He is glad, though he doesn't know why. It is unreasonable of him to think other women shouldn't have his wife's name. Bess is no great beauty, and darker than her sister, but she has a confident vivacity that compels the eye.
Be kind to Jane, Master Secretary, Bess says. She is not proud, as some people think. They wonder why she doesn't speak to them, but it's only because she can't think what to say.
But she will speak to me.
She will listen.
An attractive quality in women.
An attractive quality in anyone, wouldn't you say? Though Jane, above all women, looks to men to tell her what she should do.
Then does she do it?
Not necessarily.
She laughs. Her fingertips brush the back of his hand.
Come, she is ready for you.
Warmed by the sun of the King of England's desire, which maiden would not glow? Not Jane. She is in deeper black, it seems, than the rest of her family, and she volunteers that she has been praying for the soul of the late Catherine. Not that she needs it, for surely if any woman has gone straight to heaven... Jane, Edward Seymour says, I am warning you now, and I want you to listen carefully and heed what I say. When you come into the king's presence, it must be as if no such woman as the late Catherine ever existed. If he hears her name in your mouth, he will cease his favour upon the instant. Look, Tom Seymour says, Cromwell here wants to know, are you truly and entirely a virgin? He could blush for her. If you aren't, Mistress Jane, he says, it can be managed. But you must tell us now. Her pale, oblivious regard.
What?
Tom Seymour.
Jane, even you must understand the question.
Is it correct that no one has ever asked for you in marriage? No contract or understanding? He feels desperate. Did you never like anybody, Jane?
I liked William Dormer, but he married Mary Sidney.
She looks up, one flash of those ice-blue eyes.
I hear they're very miserable.
The Dormers didn't think we were good enough, Tom says.
But now look.
He says, It is to your credit, Mistress Jane, that you have formed no attachments till your family were ready to marry you. For young women often do, and then it ends badly. He feels that he should clarify the point. Men will tell you that they are so in love with you that it is making them ill. They will say they have stopped eating and sleeping. They say that they fear unless they can have you, they will die. Then, the moment you give in, they get up and walk away and lose all interest. The next week, they will pass you by as if they don't know you.
Did you do this, Master Secretary? Jane asks.
He hesitates. Well, Tom Seymour says, we would like to know. I probably did, when I was young. I am telling you in case your brothers cannot bring themselves to tell you. It is not a pretty thing for a man to have to admit to his sister. So you see, Edward urges, you must not give in to the king. Jane says,
why would I want to do that?
His honeyed words, Edward begins.
His what?
The Emperor's ambassador has been skulking indoors and won't come out to meet Thomas Cromwell. He would not go up to Peterborough for Catherine's funeral because she was not being buried as a queen, and now he says he has to observe his mourning period. Finally, a meeting is arranged. The ambassador will happen to be coming back from Mass at the Church of Austin Friars, while Thomas Cromwell, now in residence at the Rolls House at Chancery Lane, has called by to inspect his building work, extensions to his principal house nearby. Ambassador, he cries, as if he were wildly surprised. The bricks ready for use today were fired last summer, when the king was still on his progress through the western counties. The clay for them was dug the winter before, and the frost was breaking down the clumps while he, Cromwell, was trying to break down Thomas More. Waiting for Chapuis to appear, he has been haranguing the bricklayer's gaffer about water penetration, which he definitely does not want. Now he takes hold of Chapuis and steers him away from the noise and dust of the saw pit. Eustache is seething with questions. You can feel them, jumping and agitating in the muscles of his arm, buzzing in the weave of his garments. This Seymour girl. It is a lightless day, still the air frigid. Today would be a good day to fish for pike, he says. The ambassador struggles to master his dismay.
Surely your servants, if you must have this fish.
Ah, Eustache, I see you do not understand the sport. Have no fear, I will teach you. What could be better for the health than to be out from dawn to dusk, hours and hours on a muddy bank, with the trees dripping above, watching your own breath on the air, alone, or with one good companion. Various ideas are fighting inside the ambassador's head. On the one hand, hours and hours with Cromwell, during which he might drop his guard, say anything. On the other hand, what good am I to my imperial master if my knees seize up entirely and I have to be carried to court in a litter?
Could we not fish for it in the summer?
He asks, without much hope. I could not risk your person. A summer pike would pull you in. He relents. The lady you mean is called Seymour, as in, Ambassador, I would like to see more of you. Though some old folk pronounce it Seymour.
I make no progress in this tongue, the ambassador complains. Anyone may say his name any way he likes, different on different days. What I hear is the family is ancient, and the woman herself not so young.
She served the Dowager Princess, you know. She was fond of Catherine. She lamented, in fact, what had befallen her. She is troubled about the Lady Mary, and they say she has sent her messages to be of good cheer. If the king continues his favour to her, she may be able to do Mary some good. The ambassador looks sceptical.
I have heard this, and also that she is of a very meek and pious character. But I fear there may be a scorpion lurking under the honey. I would like to see Mistress Seymour. Can you arrange that? Not to meet her, to glimpse her.
I am surprised that you take so much interest. I should have thought you would be more interested in which French princess Henry will marry, should he dissolve his present arrangements. Now the ambassador is stretched tight on the ladder of terror. Better the devil you know? Better Anne Boleyn than a new threat, a new treaty, a new alliance between France and England?
But surely not, he explodes. Cromwell, you told me that this was a fairy tale. You have expressed yourself a friend of my master. You will not countenance a French match?
Calmly, Ambassador, calmly. I do not claim I can govern Henry. And after all, he may decide to continue with his present marriage, or if not, to live chaste.
You are laughing, the ambassador accuses. Cromwell, you are laughing behind your hand.
And so he is. The builders skirt around them, giving them space, rough London craftsmen with tools stuck in their belts. Penitent, he says, do not get your hopes up. When the king and his woman have one of their reconciliations, it goes hard with anyone who has spoken out against her in the interim.
You would maintain her? You would support her?
The ambassador's whole body has stiffened, as if he had really been on that riverbank all day.
She may be your co-religionist.
What? He opens his eyes wide. My co-religionist? Like my master the king, I am a faithful son of the Holy Catholic Church. Only just now we are not in communion with the Pope.
Let me put it another way, Chapuis says.
He squints up at the grey London sky as if seeking help from above.
Let us say your ties to her are material, not spiritual. I understand that you have had preferment from her. I am aware of that.
Do not mistake me. I owe Anne nothing. I have preferment from the king, from no one else.
You have sometimes called her your dear friend. I remember occasions.
I have sometimes called you my dear friend. But you're not, are you? Chapuis digests the point.
There is nothing I wish to see more, he says, than peace between our nations. What could better mark an ambassador's success in his post than a rapprochement after years of trouble? And now we have the opportunity.
Now Catherine is gone. Chapuis does not argue with that. He just winds his cloak closer about him.
The king has got no good of the concubine and will get none now. No power in Europe recognizes his marriage. Even the heretics do not recognize it, though she has done her best to make friends of them. What profit can there be to you in keeping matters as they are? The king unhappy, Parliament fretful, the nobility fractious, the whole country revolted by the woman's pretensions.
Slow drops of rain have begun to fall, ponderous, icy. Chapuis glances up again, irritably, as if God were undermining him at this crucial point. Taking a grip on the ambassador once more, he tows him over the rough ground towards shelter. The builders have put up a canopy, and he turns them out, saying, "Give us a minute, boys, will you?" Chapuis huddles by the brazier and grows confidential.
"I hear the king talks of witchcraft," he whispers. "He says that he was seduced into the marriage by certain charms and false practices. I see he does not confide in you, but he has spoken to his confessor. If this is so, if he entered into the match in a state of entrancement, then he might find he is not married at all and free to take a new wife."
He gazes over the ambassador's shoulder. "Look," he says, "this is how it will be. In a year these damp and freezing spaces will be inhabited rooms." His hand sketches the line of the jetted upper stories, the glazed bays. Inventories for this project, lime and sand, oak timbers and special cements, spades and shovels, baskets and ropes, tackets, pin nails, roof nails, lead pipes, tiles yellow and tiles blue, window locks, latches, bolts and hinges, iron door handles in the shape of roses, gilding, painting, 2 pounds of frankincense to perfume the new rooms, 6 pence per day per labourer, and the cost of candles for labour by night.
"My friend," Chapuis says, "Anne is desperate and dangerous. Strike first before she strikes you. Remember how she brought down Wolsey."
His past lies about him like a burnt house. He has been building, building, but it has taken him years to sweep up the mess. At the Royals' house, he finds his son, who is packing to go away for the next phase of his education. "Gregory, You know St. Uncumber? You say that women pray to her to be rid of useless husbands. Now, is there a saint that men can pray to if they wish to be quit of their wives?
I don't think so.
Gregory is shocked. The women pray because they have no other means. A man can consult a cleric to find why the marriage is not licit, or he can chase her away and pay her money to stay in a separate house, as the Duke of Norfolk pays his wife.
He nods.
That's very helpful, Gregory. Anne Boleyn comes up to Whitehall to celebrate the feast of St. Matthias with the king. She has changed, all in a season. She is light, starved. She looks as she did in her days of waiting, those futile years of negotiations before he, Thomas Cromwell, came along and cut the knot. Her flamboyant liveliness has faded to something austere, narrow, almost nun-like. But she does not have a nun's composure. Her fingers play with the jewels at her girdle, tug at her sleeves, touch and retouch the jewels at her throat. Lady Rochford says, "She thought that when she was queen she would take comfort in going over the days of her coronation hour by hour. But she says she has forgotten them. When she tries to remember, it's as if it happened to someone else and she wasn't there. She didn't tell me this, of course. She told Brother George." From the Queen's rooms comes a dispatch. A prophetess has told her that she will not bear Henry a son while his daughter Mary is alive. "You have to admire it," he says to his nephew. "She is on the offensive. She is like a serpent. You do not know when she will strike." He has always rated Anne highly as a strategist. He has never believed in her as a passionate, spontaneous woman. Everything she does is calculated, like everything he does. He notes, as he has these many years, the careful deployment of her flashing eyes. He wonders what it would take to make her panic. The king sings, "My most desire my hand may reach, my will is always at my hand. Me need not long for to beseech her that has power me to command." So he thinks. He can beseech and beseech, but it has no effect on Jane. But the nation's business must go forward, and this is how. An act to give Wales members of Parliament, and make English the language of the law courts, and to cut from under them the powers of the lords of the Welsh marches. An act to dissolve the small monasteries, those houses worth under £200 a year. An act to set up a court of augmentations, a new body to deal with the inflow of revenue from these monasteries. Richard Rich to be its chancellor. In March, Parliament knocks back his new poor law. It was too much for the commons to digest, that rich men might have some duty to the poor, that if you get fat, as gentlemen of England do, on the wool trade, you have some responsibility to the men turned off the land, the labourers without labour, the sowers without a field. England needs roads, forts, harbours, bridges. Men need work. It's a shame to see them begging their bread, when honest labour could keep the realm secure. Can we not put them together, the hands and the task? But Parliament cannot see how it is the state's job to create work. Are not these matters in God's hands? And is not poverty and dereliction part of his eternal order? To everything there is a season, a time to starve and a time to thieve. If rain falls for 6 months solid and rots the grain in the fields, there must be providence in it, for God knows his trade. It is an outrage to the rich and enterprising to suggest that they should pay an income tax only to put bread in the mouths of the work-shy. And if Secretary Cromwell argues that famine provokes criminality, well, are there not hangmen enough? The king himself comes to the Commons to argue for the law. He wants to be Henry the Beloved, a father to his people, a shepherd to his flock. But the Commons sit stony-faced on their benches and stare him out. The wreckage of the measure is comprehensive. "It has ended up as an act for the whipping of beggars," Richard Rich says. "It is more against the poor than for them."
"Perhaps we can bring it in again," Henry says, "in a better year. Do not lose heart, Master Secretary."
So, there will be better years, will there? He will keep trying. Sneak it past them when they're off their guard. Start off the measure in the Lords and face down the opposition. There are ways and ways with Parliament, but there are times he wishes he could kick the members back to their own shires, because he could get on faster without them. He says, "If I were king, I would not take it so quietly. I would make them shake in their shoes." Richard Rich is Mr. Speaker in this Parliament. He says nervously,
"Don't incense the king, sir. You know what Moore used to say? If the lion knew his own strength, it were hard to rule him."
"Thank you," he says. "That consoles me mightily, Sir Purse. A text from the grave, from that blood-soaked hypocrite. Has he anything else to say about the situation? Because if so, I'm going to get his head back off his daughter and boot it up and down Whitehall till he shuts up for good and all." He bursts into laughter. "The Commons! God rot them! Their heads are empty. They never think higher than their pockets." Still, if his fellows in Parliament are worried about their incomes, he is buoyant about his own. Though the lesser monastic houses are to be dissolved, they may apply for exemptions, and all these applications come to him, accompanied by a fee or a pension. The king will not keep all his new lands in his own name, but lease them out, so continual application is made to him for this place or that, for manors, farms, pasture. Each applicant offers him a little something, a one-off payment or an annuity that will pass to Gregory in time. It's the way business has always been done, favours, sweeteners, a timely transfer of funds to secure attention, or a promise of split proceeds. Just now there is so much business, so many transactions, so many offers he can hardly in civility decline. No man in England works harder than he does. Say what you like about Thomas Cromwell, he offers good value for what he takes, and he's always ready to lend. William Fitzwilliam, Sir Nicholas Carew, that aging one-eyed reprobate, Francis Bryan. He gets Sir Francis round and gets him drunk. He, Cromwell, can trust himself. When he was young, he learned to drink with Germans. It's over a year since Francis Bryan quarrelled with George Boleyn. Over what, Francis hardly remembers. But the grudge remains, and until his legs go from under him, he is able to act out the more florid bits of the row, standing up and waving his arms. Of his cousin Anne, he says, "You like to know where you are with a woman. Is she a harlot or a lady? Anne wants you to treat her like the Virgin Mary, but she also wants you to put your cash on the table, do the business, and get out." Sir Francis is intermittently pious, as conspicuous sinners tend to be. Lent is here. "It is time for you to enter into your yearly frenzy of penitence, is it not?" Francis pushes up the patch on his blind eye and rubs the scar tissue. "It itches," he explains. "Of course," he says, "Wyatt's had her." He, Thomas Cromwell, waits. But then Francis puts his head down on the table and begins to snore. "The Vicar of Hell," he says thoughtfully. He calls for boys to come in. "Take Sir Francis home to his own people. But wrap him up warm, we may need his testimony in the days to come." He wonders exactly how much you'd have to leave on the table for Anne. She's cost Henry his honour, his peace of mind. To him, Cromwell, she is just another trader. He admires the way she's laid out her goods. He personally doesn't want to buy, but there are customers enough. Now Edward Seymour is promoted into the king's privy chamber, a singular mark of favour, and the king says to him, "I think I should have young Ralph Sadler among my grooms. He is a gentleman born, and a pleasant young man to have near me, and I think it would help you, Cromwell, would it not? Only he is not forever to be putting papers under my nose." Ralph's wife Helen bursts into tears when she hears the news. "He will be away at court," she says, "for weeks at a time." He sits with her in the parlour at Brick Place, consoling her as best he can. "This is the best thing that has ever happened for Ralph, I know," she says. "I'm a fool to weep over it, but I cannot bear to be parted from him, nor he from me. When he is late, I send men to look along the road. I wish we could be under the same roof every night we live." "He is a lucky man," he says. "And I don't mean just lucky in the king's favour. You are both of you lucky. To love so much." Henry used to sing a song in his Catherine days. I hurt no man, I do no wrong, I love true where I did marry. Rafe says, you need a steady nerve to be always with Henry. You have a steady nerve, Rafe. He could give him advice, extracts from the book called Henry. As a child, a young man, praised for the sweetness of his nature and his golden looks, Henry grew up believing that all the world was his friend, and everybody wanted him to be happy. So any pain, any delay, frustration, or stroke of ill luck seems to him an anomaly, an outrage. Any activity he finds wearying or displeasant, he will try honestly to turn into an amusement, and if he cannot find some thread of pleasure, he will avoid it. This to him seems reasonable and natural. He has counselors employed to fry their brains on his behalf, and if he is out of temper, it is probably their fault. They shouldn't block him or provoke him. He doesn't want people who say no, but he wants people who say yes, and he doesn't like men who are pessimistic and skeptical, who turn down their mouths and cost out his brilliant projects with a scribble in the margin of their papers. So do the sums in your head where no one can see them. Do not expect consistency from him. Henry prides himself on understanding his counselors, their secret opinions and desires, but he is resolved that none of his counselors shall understand him. He is suspicious of any plan that doesn't originate with himself, or seem to. You can argue with him, but you must be careful how and when. You are better to give way on every possible point until the vital point, and to pose yourself as one in need of guidance and instruction, rather than to maintain a fixed opinion from the start and let him think you believe you know better than he does. Be sinuous in argument and allow him escapes. Don't corner him, don't back him against the wall. Remember that his mood depends on other people, so consider who has been with him since you were with him last. Remember, he wants more than to be advised of his power. He wants to be told he is right. He is never in error. It is only that other people commit errors on his behalf or deceive him with false information. Henry wants to be told that he is behaving well, in the sight of God and man.
Cromwell, he says, you know what we should try? Cromwell, would it not reflect well on my honour if I... Cromwell, would it not confound my enemies if...
And all these are the ideas you put to him last week. Never mind. You don't want the credit. You just want action. But there is no need for these lessons. All his life Rafe has been training for this. A scrap of a boy, he is no athlete. He could never exercise himself in tilt or tournament. A stray breeze would whisk him out of the saddle. But he has the heft for this. He knows how to watch. He knows how to listen. He knows how to send a message encrypted, or a message so secret that no message appears to be there. A piece of information so solid that its meaning seems to be stamped out in the earth, yet its form so fragile that it seems to be conveyed by angels. Rafe knows his master. Henry is his master. But Cromwell is his father and his friend. You can be merry with the king, you can share a joke with him, but as Thomas More used to say, it's like sporting with a tamed lion. You tousle its mane and pull its ears, but all the time you're thinking, those claws, those claws, those claws. In Henry's new church, Lent is as raw and cold as ever it was under the Pope. Miserable, meatless days fray a man's temper. When Henry talks about Jane, he blinks, tears spring to his eyes.
Her little hands, Crumb, her little paws, like a child's. She has no guile in her, and she never speaks. And if she does, I have to bend my ear to hear what she says. And in the paws I can hear my heart. Her little bits of embroidery, her scraps of silk, her halcyon sleeves she cut out of the cloth some admirer gave her once, some poor boy struck with love for her. And yet she has never succumbed. Her little sleeves, her seed-pearl necklace. She has nothing. She expects nothing.
A tear at last sneaks from Henry's eye, meanders down his cheek and vanishes into the mottled grey and ginger of his beard. Notice how he speaks of Jane. So humble, so shy. Even Archbishop Cranmer must recognize the portrait. The black reverse portrait of the present queen. All the riches of the new world would not sate her, while Jane is grateful for a smile. I'm going to write Jane a letter, Henry says. I'm going to send her a purse, for she will need money for herself now she is removed from the queen's chamber. Paper and quills are brought to his hand. He sits down and sighs and sets about it. The king's handwriting is square, the hand he learned as a child from his mother. He's never picked up speed. The more effort he puts into it, the more the letters seem to turn back on themselves. He takes pity on him. Sir, would you like to dictate it? And I will write for you. It would not be the first time he has written a love letter for Henry. Over their sovereign's bent head, Cranmer looks up and meets his eyes, full of accusation.
Have a look, Henry says.
He doesn't offer it to Cranmer.
She'll understand, yes, that I want her?
He reads, trying to put himself in the place of a maiden lady. He looks up. It is very delicately expressed, sir. And she is very innocent. Henry takes the letter back and writes in a few reinforcing phrases. It is the end of March. Mistress Seymour, stricken with panic, seeks an interview with Mr. Secretary. It is set up by Sir Nicholas Carew, though Sir Nicholas himself is absent, not yet ready to commit himself to talks. Her widowed sister is with her. Bess gives him a searching glance, then drops her bright eyes.
Here is my difficulty, Jane says.
She looks at him wildly. He thinks maybe that's all she means to say. Here is my difficulty. She says,
You can't. His Grace, His Majesty, you can't for one moment forget who he is, even though he demands you do. The more he says, Jane, I am your humble suitor, the less humble you know he is. And every moment you are thinking, what if he stops talking and I have to say something? I feel as if I'm standing on a pincushion, with the pins pointing up. I keep thinking, I'll get used to it. Next time I'll be better, but when he comes in, Jane, Jane, I'm like a scalded cat. Though, have you ever seen a scalded cat, Master Secretary? I have not. But I think, if after this short time I'm so frightened of him...
He wants people to be frightened. With the words arrives the truth of them. But Jane is too intent on her own struggles to hear what he has said.
If I'm frightened of him now, what will it be like to see him every day?
She breaks off.
Oh, I suppose you know. You do see him, Master Secretary, most days. Still, not the same, I suppose.
No, not the same, he says. He sees Bess, in sympathy, raise her eyes to her sister.
But Master Cromwell... Bess says, it cannot always be acts of Parliament and dispatches to ambassadors and revenue and whales and monks and pirates and traitorous devices and Bibles and oaths and trusts and wards and leases and the price of wool and whether we should pray for the dead. There must sometimes be other topics.
He is struck by her overview of his situation. It is as if she has understood his life. He is taken by an impulse to clasp her hand and ask her to marry him, even if they did not get on in bed. She seems to have a gift for précis that eludes most of his clerks.
Well, Jane says, are there other topics?
He can't think. He squashes his soft hat between his hands. Horses, he says. Henry likes to know about trades and crafts. Simple things. In my youth, I learned to shoe a horse. He likes to know about that. The right shoe for the job, so he can confound his own smiths with secret knowledge. The Archbishop, too, he is a man who will ride any horse that comes to his hand. He is a timid man, but horses like him. He learned to manage them when he was young. When he is tired of God and men, we speak of these matters with the king.
And, Bess says, you are together many hours.
Dogs. Sometimes. Hunting dogs, their breeding and virtues. Fortresses, building them. Artillery, the range of it. Cannon founders. Dear God. He runs his hand through his hair. We sometimes say we will have a day out together, ride down to Kent, to the Weald, to see the ironmasters there study their operations and propose them new ways of casting cannon. But we never do it. Something is always in our way. He feels irredeemably sad, as if he has been plunged into mourning. And at the same time he feels, if someone tossed a feather bed into the room, which is unlikely, he would throw Bess onto it and have to do with her.
"Well, that's that," Jane says, her tone resigned. "I could not found a cannon to save my life. I am sorry to have taken your time, Master Secretary. You had better get back to Wales."
He knows what she means. Next day, the King's love letter is brought to Jane, with a heavy purse. It is a scene staged before witnesses.
"I must return this purse," Jane says.
But she does not say it before she has weighed it, fondled it in her tiny hand.
"I must beg the King, if he wishes to make me a present of money, to send it again when I should contract an honourable marriage."
Given the King's letter, she declares she had better not open it, for well she knows his heart, his gallant and ardent heart. For herself, her only possession is her womanly honour, her maidenhead. So, no, really, she had better not break the seal. And then, before she returns it to the messenger, she holds it in her two hands and places on the seal a chaste kiss.
"She kissed it!" Tom Seymour cries. "What genius possessed her? First his seal, next," he sniggers, "his sceptre!"
In a fit of joy, he knocks his brother Edward's hat off. He has been playing this joke for 20 years or more, and Edward has never been amused. But just this once he fetches up a smile. When the King gets the letter back from Jane, he listens closely to what his messenger has to tell him, and his face lights up.
"I see I was wrong to send it. Cromwell here has spoken to me of her innocence and her virtue, and with good reason, as it appears. From this point I will do nothing that will offend her honour. In fact, I shall only speak to her in the presence of her kin."
If Edward Seymour's wife were to come to court, they could make a family party, with whom the King could take supper without any affront to Jane's modesty. Perhaps Edward should have a suite in the palace. "Those rooms of mine at Greenwich," he reminds Henry, "that communicate directly with yours. What if I were to move out and let the Seymours move in?" Henry beams at him. He has been studying the Seymour brothers intently since the visit to Wolfe Hall. He will have to work with them. Henry's women come trailing families. He does not find his brides in the forest, hiding under a leaf. Edward is grave, serious, yet he is ready to unfold his thoughts to you. Tom is close, that's what he thinks, close and cunning, brain busily working beneath that show of bonhomie, but it's perhaps not the best brain. Tom Seymour will give me no trouble, he thinks, and Edward I can carry with me. His mind is already moving ahead to a time when the King indicates his pleasure. Gregory and the Emperor's ambassador between them have suggested the way forward.
"If he can annul 20 years with his true wife," Chapuis has said to him, "I am sure it is not beyond your wit to find some grounds to free him from his concubine. No one has ever believed the marriage was good in the first place, except those who are employed to say yes to him."
He wonders, though, about the ambassador's "no one." No one in the Emperor's court, perhaps. But all England has sworn to the marriage. It is not a light matter, he tells his nephew Richard, to undo it legally, even if the King commanded it. We shall wait a little. We will not go to anyone. Let them come to us. He asks for a document to be drawn up showing all grants to the Boleyns since 1524. Such a thing would be good to have at hand in case the King calls for it. He does not mean to take anything away, rather enhance their holdings, load them with honours, laugh at their jokes. Though you must be careful what you laugh at. Master Sexton, the King's jester, has jested about Anne and called her a ribald. He thought he had license, but Henry lumbered across the hall and clouted him, banged his head on the panelling and banished him the court. They say Nicholas Carew gave the man refuge out of pity. Antony is aggrieved about Sexton. One jester does not like to hear of the downfall of another, especially, Antony says, when his only vice is foresight. Oh, he says, you have been listening to the gossip in the kitchen. But the fool says,
Henry kicks out the truth and Master Sexton with it. But these days has a way of creeping under the bolted door and down the chimney. One day he will give in and invite it to stand by the hearth.
William Fitzwilliam comes to the Royal's house and sits down with him. So how does the Queen, Crumb? Still perfect friends, though you dine with the Seymours? He smiles. Fitzwilliam jumps up, wrenches the door open to see no one is lurking, then sits down again and resumes.
Cast your mind back. This Boleyn courtship, this Boleyn marriage, how did the King look in the eyes of grown men? Like one who only studies his own pleasures, like a child, that is to say. To be so impassioned, to be so enslaved by a woman who, after all, is made just as other women are, some said it was unmanly.
Did they? Well, I am shocked. We cannot have it said of Henry that he is not a man.
A man, and Fitzwilliam stresses the word, a man should be governor of his passions. Henry shows much force of will, but little wisdom. It harms him. She harms him. The harm will go on.
It seems he will not name her. Anna Bolena, La Anna, the concubine. So, if she harms the king, would it be the act of a good Englishman to remove her? The possibility lies between them, approached but still unexplored. It is treason, of course, to speak against the present queen and her heirs, a treason from which the king alone is exempt, for he could not violate his own interest. He reminds Fitzwilliam of this. He adds, even if Henry speaks against her, do not be drawn.
But what do we look for in a queen? Fitzwilliam asks. She should have all the virtues of an ordinary woman, but she must have them to a high degree. She must be more modest, more humble, more discreet, and more obedient even than they, so that she sets an example. There are those who ask themselves, is Anne Boleyn any of these things?
He looks at Master Treasurer. Go on.
I think I can speak frankly to you, Cromwell, Fitz says, and after checking at the door once again, he does. A queen should be mild and pitiful. She should move the king to mercy, not drive him on to harshness.
You have some particular case in mind? Fitz was in Wolsey's household as a young man. No one knows what part Anne played in the fall of the cardinal. Her hand was hidden in her sleeve. Wolsey knew he could hope for no mercy from her, and he received none. But Fitz seems to brush away the cardinal. He says,
I hold no brief for Thomas More. He was not the adept in affairs of state that he thought he was. He thought he could sway the king. He thought he could control him. He thought that Henry was still a sweet young prince he could lead by the hand. But Henry is a king, and he will be obeyed.
Yes. And?
And I wish that with More it could have ended another way. A scholar, a man who was Lord Chancellor, to drag him out in the rain and cut off his head.
He says, you know, sometimes I forget he's gone. There is some piece of news, and I think, what will More say to this? Fitz glances up.
You don't talk to him, do you?
He laughs. I don't go to him for advice. Though I do, of course, consult the Cardinal, in the privacy of my short hours of sleep. Fitz says,
Thomas More scuttled his chances with Anne when he would not come to see her crowned. She would have seen him dead a year before it happened if she could have proved treason on him.
But More was a clever lawyer, amongst the other things he was.
The Princess Mary, the Lady Mary, I should say, she is no lawyer, a friendless girl.
Oh, I would think that her cousin the Emperor counts as her friend. And a very good friend to have, too. Fitz looks irritated.
The Emperor is a great idol set up in another country. Day by day she needs a more proximate defender. She needs someone to push forward her interests. Stop this, Crumb, this dancing around the point.
Mary just needs to keep breathing, he says. I am not often accused of dancing. Fitzwilliam stands up.
Well now, a word to the wise.
The feeling is that something is wrong in England and must be set right. It's not the laws that are wrong or the customs. It's something deeper. Fitzwilliam leaves the room. Then he comes back in, says abruptly,
If it is old Seymour's daughter next,
There will be some jealousy among those who think their own noble house should be preferred. But after all, the Seymours are an ancient family, and he won't have this trouble with her. I mean, men running after her like dogs after a... Well, you just look at her, Seymour's little girl, and you know that nobody's ever pulled her skirts up. This time he does go, but giving him, Cromwell, a sort of mock salute, a flourish in the direction of his hat. Sir Nicholas Carew comes to see him. The very fibres of his beard are bristling with conspiracy. He half expects the knight to wink as he sits down. When it comes to it, Carew is surprisingly brisk. "We want the concubine ousted. We know you want it too." "We?" Carew looks up at him from beneath bristling brows. Like a man who has shot off his one crossbow bolt, he must now plod over the terrain, seeking friend or foe, or just a place to hide for the night. Ponderously, he clarifies. "My friends in this matter do comprise a good part of the ancient nobility of this nation, those of honourable lineage, and..." He sees Cromwell's face and hurries on. "I speak of those very near the throne, those in the line of old King Edward, Lord Exeter, the Courtenay family, also Lord Montague and his brother Geoffrey Pole, Lady Margaret Pole, who, as you know, was governor to the Princess Mary." He casts up his eyes. "Lady Mary." "If you must. We call her the Princess." He nods. "We will not let that stop us discussing her." "Those I have named," Carew says, "are the principal persons on whose behalf I speak. But as you will be aware, the most part of England would rejoice to see the king free of her." "I don't think the most part of England knows or cares." Carew means, of course, the most part of my England, the England of ancient blood. Any other country, for Sir Nicholas, does not exist. He says, "I suppose Exeter's wife Gertrude is active in this matter." "She has been," Carew leans forward to impart something very secret, "in communication with Mary." "I know," he sighs. "You read their letters?"
"I read everybody's letters."
"Including yours."
"But look," he says, "this smells of intrigue against the king himself, does it not?"
"In no wise. His honour is at the heart of it."
He nods. "Point taken." "And so, what do you require of me?"
"We require you to join us. We are content to have Seymour's girl crowned. The young woman is my kin, and she is known to favour true religion. We believe she will bring Henry back to Rome."
"A cause close to my heart," he murmurs.
Sir Nicholas leans forward. "This is our difficulty, Cromwell. You are a Lutheran." He touches his jacket, round about his heart.
"No, sir. I am a banker. Luther condemns to hell those who lend at interest. Is it likely that I should take his part?"
Sir Nicholas laughs heartily.
"I did not know. Where would we be without Cromwell to lend us money?"
He asks, "What is to happen to Anne Boleyn?"
"I don't know. Convent?"
So the bargain is struck and sealed. He, Cromwell, is to assist the old families, the true faithful, and afterwards, under the new regime, they will keep his services in consideration. His zeal in this matter may cause them to forget the blasphemies of these last 3 years, which otherwise would invite condign punishment.
"Just one thing, Cromwell," Carew stands up. "Don't keep me waiting next time. It ill becomes a man of your stamp to keep a man of my stamp kicking his heels in an anteroom."
Ah, was that the noise? Though Carew wears the padded satin of the courtier, he always imagines him in show armour, not the kind you fight in, the kind you buy from Italy to impress your friends. Heel kicking would be a noisy business then. Clatter, clang. He looks up. "I meant no slight, Sir Nicholas. From now we will make all speed. Consider me at your right hand, furnished for the fight." That's the sort of bombast Carew understands. Now Fitzwilliam is talking to Carew. Carew is talking to his wife, who is Francis Bryan's sister. His wife is talking, or writing at least, to Mary, to let her know that her prospects are improving by the hour, that La Anna may be displaced. At the very least, it's a way of keeping Mary quiet for the while. He doesn't want her to hear the rumours that Anne is launching fresh hostilities. She may panic and try to escape. They say she has various absurd plans, like drugging the Boleyn women about her and spurring off by night. He has warned Chapuis, though not in so many words, of course, that if Mary does escape, Henry is likely to hold him responsible, and to have no regard for the protection of his diplomatic status. At the very least, he will be booted around like Sexton the Jester. At worst, he may never see his native shores again. Francis Bryan is keeping the Seymours at Wolf Hall abreast of events at court. Fitzwilliam and Carew are talking to the Marquis of Exeter and Gertrude, his wife. Gertrude is talking over supper to the Imperial Ambassador and to the Pole family, who are as papist as they dare to be, who have teetered on the edge of treason these last 4 years. No one is talking to the French ambassador. But everyone is talking to him, Thomas Cromwell. In sum, this is the question his new friends are asking. If Henry can retire one wife, and she a daughter of Spain, can he not give a pension to Boleyn's daughter and put her away in some country house, having found defects in the marriage documents? His casting off of Catherine after 20 years of marriage offended all Europe. The marriage with Anne is recognized nowhere but in this realm, and has not endured 3 years. He could annul it as a folly. After all, he has his own church to do so, his own archbishop. In his head he rehearses a request. Sir Nicholas, Sir William, will you come to my humble house to dine? He does not really mean to ask them. Word would soon reach the Queen. A coded glance is enough, a nod and a wink. But once again in his mind he sets the table. Norfolk at the head. Montague and his sainted mother. Courtney and his blasted wife. Sliding in behind them, our friend Monsieur Chapuis.
"Oh, damn it," Norfolk sulks. "Now must we speak French?"
"I will translate," he offers. "But who's this clattering in? It's Duke Dishpan." "Welcome, my Lord Suffolk," he says. "Take a seat. Careful not to get crumbs in that great beard of yours."
"If there were a crumb."
Norfolk is hungry. Margaret Pole spears him with a glacial stare.
"You have set a table, you have given us all seats, you have given us no napery."
"My apologies." He calls for a servant. "You wouldn't want to get your hands dirty." Margaret Pole shakes out her napkin. On it is imprinted the face of the dead Catherine. A bawling comes from without, the direction of the buttery. Francis Bryan reels in, already a bottle to the good.
"Pass time with good company,"
he crashes to his place. Now he, Cromwell, nods to his menials. Extra stools are fetched. "Squeeze them in," he says. Carew and Fitzwilliam enter. They take their places without a smile or a nod. They have come ready to the feast, their knives in their hands. He looks around at his guests. All are prepared. A Latin grace. English would be his choice, but he will suit his company. Who cross themselves ostentatiously in papist style, who look at him expectant. He shouts for the waiters. The doors burst open. Sweating men heave the platters to the table. It seems the meat is fresh. In fact, not slaughtered yet. It is just a minor breach of etiquette. The company must sit and salivate. The Boleyns are laid at his hand to be carved.
This ends Disc 6.